just before the market hit bottom. They also pulled their money out of growth funds and turned, too late, to value funds. The underwhelming performance of fund investors returned during the financial crisis of 2008 to 2009 and the subsequent recovery. Fund investors have been chasing past performance since time immemorial, allowing their emotions, perhaps even their greed, to overwhelm their reason. Many investors reacted strongly, and ultimately counterproductively, to the sharp downturn in the markets during the financial crisis by getting out of stocks near the market's nadir. Many of those investors missed part or even all of the subsequent recovery, a cumulative increase by the end of 2016 of some 250% from the low. Investor emotions plus fund industry promotions equals trouble. The fund industry itself has compounded the problem by playing on investors' emotions, bringing out new funds to meet the fads and fashions of the day, often supercharged and speculative, and then aggressively advertising and marketing them. It is fair to say that when counterproductive investor emotions are played upon by counterproductive fund industry promotions, little good is apt to result. The fund industry will not soon give up on its new products or its promotions, and it will take time and first-hand experience by investors with counterproductive short-term behavior to gain wisdom. But the intelligent investor will be well advised to heed not only the message in Chapter 4 about minimizing expenses, but the message in this chapter about removing emotions from the equation. That is, about investors improving their short-term market-oriented behavior. The beauty of the index fund, then, lies not only in its low expenses, but in its elimination of all those tempting fund choices that promise so much and deliver so little. Focusing on the long term, doing one's best to ignore the short-term noise of the stock market, and eschewing the hot funds of the day, the index fund can be held through thick and thin for an investment lifetime. Emotions need never enter the equation. The winning formula for success in investing is owning the entire stock market through an index fund, and then doing nothing. Just stay the course. Don't take my word for it. The wise Warren Buffett shares my view. Consider what I call his four E's. The greatest enemies of the equity investor are expenses and emotions. So does Andrew Low, MIT professor and author of Adaptive Markets, 2017, who personally invests by buying and holding index funds. Perhaps even more surprisingly, the founder and chief executive of the largest mutual fund supermarket, while vigorously promoting stock trading and actively managed funds, favors the classic index fund for himself. When asked why people invest in managed funds, Charles Schwab answered, "It's fun to play around. It's human nature to try to select the right horse. But for the average person, I'm more of an indexer. The predictability is so high. For 10, 15, 20 years, you'll be in the 85th percentile of performance. Why would you screw it up?" Most of Mr. Schwab's personal portfolio is invested in index funds. Mark Hulbert, editor of the highly regarded Hulbert Financial Digest, concurs, "Assuming that the future is like the past, you can outperform 80% of your fellow investors over the next several decades by investing in an index fund and doing nothing else. Acquire the discipline to do something even better than trying to beat the market. Become a long-term index fund investor." His New York Times article was headlined, "Buy and Hold? Sure, but don't forget the hold." Chapter 8. Taxes are costs, too. Don't pay Uncle Sam any more than you should. We still aren't through with these relentless rules of humble arithmetic, the logical, inevitable, and unyielding long-term penalties assessed against stock market participants by investment expenses, the powerful impact of inflation, counterproductive investor behavior, and fund industry promotion of untested and hot mutual funds. These practices have slashed the capital accumulated by mutual fund investors. The index fund has provided excellent protection from the penalty of nearly all of these hidden costs. Of course, the index fund's real returns were not exempt from the ravages of inflation, which impact all investments equally. But there is yet another cost, too often ignored, that slashes even further the net returns that investors actually receive. I'm referring to taxes, federal, state, and local income taxes. About one-half of all equity mutual fund shares are held by individual investors in fully taxable investment accounts. The other half are held in tax-deferred accounts, such as individual retirement accounts, IRAs, and corporate savings, thrift, and profit-sharing plans. If your fund holdings are solely in the latter category, you need not be concerned with the discussion in this chapter. And here again, the index fund garners a substantial edge. The fact is that most managed mutual funds are astonishingly tax inefficient. Why? Because of the short-term focus of their portfolio managers, who too often are frenetic traders of the stocks in the portfolios that they supervise. Managed mutual funds are astonishingly tax inefficient. The portfolio turnover of the average actively managed equity fund, including both purchases and sales, now comes to 78% per year. The traditional turnover rate, which includes only the lesser of purchases or sales, is 39%. Industry-wide, the average stock is held by the average active fund for an average of just 19 months. Based on total assets, the average holding period is 31 months. Hard as it is to imagine, from 1945 to 1965, the annual turnover rate of equity funds averaged just 16%, an average holding period of 6 years for the average stock in a fund portfolio. This huge increase in turnover and its attendant transaction costs have ill-served fund investors. But the baneful impact of excessive taxes that funds have passed through to their investors have made a bad situation worse. This pattern of tax inefficiency for active managers seems destined to continue as long as, one, stocks rise, and, two, fund managers continue their pattern of hyperactive trading. Let's be clear. In an earlier era, most fund managers focused on long-term investment. Now they are too often focused on short-term speculation. The traditional index fund follows precisely the opposite policy, buying and holding forever. Its annual portfolio turnover has run in the range of 3%, resulting in transaction costs that are somewhere between infinitesimal and zero. Bring on the data. So let's pick up where we left off a few chapters ago. Recall that the net annual return was 7.8% for the average equity fund over the past 25 years and 9.0% for the S&P 500 index fund. With the high portfolio turnover of actively managed funds, their taxable investors were subject to an estimated effective annual federal tax of 1.2 percentage points per year, or about 15% of their total pre-tax return. State and local taxes would further balloon the figure. Result, their after-tax annual return was cut to 6.6%. Despite the higher returns that they earned, investors in the index fund were actually subjected to lower taxes, largely derived from their dividend income. The extremely low costs of index funds consume less dividend income relative to actively managed funds, resulting in higher dividend yields and, therefore, higher taxes on dividends. In mid-2017, the dividend yield on a low-cost Standard & Poor's 500 index fund totaled 2.0%, double the yield on the average actively managed equity fund. Federal taxes cost taxable investors in index funds about 0.45% per year, only about one-third of the 1.5% annual tax burden borne by investors in actively managed funds. Given that active funds often distribute substantial short-term capital gains to their shareholders, which are taxed at higher ordinary income rates, not the lower long-term capital gains rate, investors in active funds face substantial tax burdens that index investors do not face. Result, The average actively managed equity fund earned an annual after-tax return of 6.6%, compared to 8.6% for the index investor. Compounded, an initial 1991 investment of $10,000 generated a profit of $39,700 after taxes for the active funds, less than 60% of the $68,300 of accumulated growth in the index fund. The active fund lag, a loss to their investors of some $28,600. The index fund investor would be subject to taxes on any gains realized when liquidating shares. But for an investor who bequeaths shares to heirs, the cost would be stepped up to their market value on date of death, and no capital gain would be recognized or taxed. Fund returns are devastated by costs, adverse fund selections, bad timing, taxes, and inflation. I hesitate to assign to any single one of these negative factors the responsibility for being the straw that broke the camel's back of equity fund returns. But surely the final straws include 1. High costs, chapters 4, 5, and 6. 2. Adverse investor selections and counterproductive market timing, chapter 7. And 3. Taxes, chapter 8. Whichever way one looks at it, the camel's back is surely broken. But the very last straw, it turns out, is inflation. Nominal returns versus real returns. When we pay our fund costs in current dollars, year after year, and that's exactly how we pay our fund expenses and our taxes on fund capital gains, often realized on a short-term basis to boot, and yet accumulate our assets only in real dollars, eroded by the relentless rise in the cost of living that has been embedded in our economy, the results are devastating. It is truly remarkable, and hardly praiseworthy, that this devastation is so often ignored in the information that mutual funds provide to their investors. A paradox. While the index fund is remarkably tax-efficient in managing capital gains, it turns out to be relatively tax-inefficient in distributing dividend income. Why? Because its rock-bottom costs mean that nearly all of the dividends paid on the stocks held by the low-cost index fund flow directly into the hands of the index fund's shareholders. Don't take my word for it. Consider these words from a paper by John B. Chauvin of Stanford University and the National Bureau of Economic Research, and Joel M. Dixon, then of the Federal Reserve System, now a principal at Vanguard. Mutual funds have failed to manage their realized capital gains in such a way as to permit a substantial deferral of taxes, raising investors' tax bills considerably. If the Vanguard 500 Index Fund could have deferred all of its realized capital gains, it would have ended up in the 91.8th percentile for the high-tax investor. That is, outpaced 92% of all managed equity funds. Or listen to investment advisor William Bernstein, author of The Four Pillars of Investing. While it is probably a poor idea to own actively managed mutual funds in general, it is truly a terrible idea to own them in taxable accounts. Taxes are a drag on performance of up to 4 percentage points each year. Many index funds allow your capital gains to grow largely undisturbed until you sell. For the taxable investor, indexing means never having to say you're sorry. And Burton G. Malkiel again casts his lot with the index fund. Index funds are tax-friendly, allowing investors to defer the realization of capital gains or avoid them completely if the shares are later bequeathed. To the extent that the long-run uptrend in stock prices continues, switching from security to security involves realizing capital gains that are subject to tax. Taxes are a crucially important financial consideration because the earlier realization of capital gains will substantially reduce net returns. Index funds do not trade from security to security, and thus they tend to avoid capital gains taxes. Chapter 9. When the good times no longer roll. It's wise to plan on lower future returns in the stock and bond markets. Remember the unfailing principle described in Chapter 2. In the long run, it is the reality of business, the dividend yields and earnings growth of corporations, that drives the returns generated by the stock market. Paradoxically, however, if we simply consider only the 43 years since I founded Vanguard on September 24, 1974, the returns provided by the stock market exceeded the returns earned by businesses by among the highest margins in any period of such length in the entire history of the U.S. market. Specifically, the dividend yields and earnings growth of the public corporations that compose the Standard & Poor's 500 Index created an investment return of but 8.8% during that period. Dividend yield 3.3%, earnings growth 5.5%. Yet, the total annual return was 11.7%. Refer to Exhibit 9.1 in the accompanying PDF. Fully 2.9 percentage points of the market's return, fully 25% of the total, were accounted for by speculative return. That return reflected an upward revaluation of stocks by investors as the price-earnings multiple more than tripled from 7.5 times earnings to 23.7 times. The average decade-long contribution of speculative return to the market's total annual return since 1900 has been but 0.5 percentage points, only about one-fifth of the bounty that we investors have enjoyed since 1974. The cumulative effects of these compounding returns are staggering. Refer to Exhibit 9.1 in the accompanying PDF. Over that 43-year period, an initial investment of $10,000 would have grown to just under $1,090,000. Of that $1 million-plus accumulation, about $270,000 can be attributed to speculative return, while the remaining $820,000 was due to dividends and earnings growth. Yes, that remarkably low P.E. multiple of 7.5 times in September 1974 came at the bottom of a 50% tumble in the stock market. It reflected deep pessimism, excessive fear, and widespread worry among investors. As 2017 begins, it remains to be seen whether the current valuation of 23.7 times earnings represents some combination of unbridled optimism, excessive confidence, exuberance, and hope, or a new reality. Both common sense and humble arithmetic tell us that we're facing an era of subdued returns in the stock market. On balance, over more than four decades, equity investors have enjoyed extraordinary returns. But since speculative return was responsible for fully 25% of the market's annual return during this period, it is unrealistic to expect P.E. multiple expansion to repeat that performance, nor to give much, if any, momentum to the investment returns earned by stocks in the decade ahead. Common sense tells us that compared to the long-term annual nominal return of 9.5% since 1900, we're again facing an era of subdued returns in the stock market. Refer to Exhibit 9.2 in the accompanying PDF. I say again because in the first, 2007 edition of this book, I used the same title for this chapter, When the Good Times No Longer Roll. There I set reasonable expectations for the return on stocks over the 2006 to 2016 decade at 7% per year. The actual return on the S&P 500 was almost identical, 6.9%. Hold the applause. I underestimated speculative return by about the same amount as I overestimated investment return. The arithmetic behind the caution. The sources of stock returns. Why the continued caution? Simply because the sources of stock returns tell us to be cautious. Recall Lord Keynes's warning cited in Chapter 2 that it is dangerous to apply to the future inductive arguments based on past experience unless one can distinguish the broad reasons for why past experience was what it was. In that chapter, I described three sources of return on stocks, the initial dividend yield and the earnings growth, together investment return, and changes in the P/E multiple, speculative return. Future annual investment return, 6%. Let's consider the sources of return as they appear today. First, today's dividend yield on stocks is not 4.4%, the historical rate, but 2%. Thus, we can expect a deadweight loss of 2.4 percentage points per year in the contribution of dividend income to investment return. As for corporate earnings, let's assume that they will continue to grow, as over time they usually have, at about the pace of our economy's expected nominal growth rate of 4% to 5% per year in gross domestic product, GDP, over the coming decade, below our nation's long-term nominal growth rate of 6% plus. If that expectation proves to be reasonably accurate, then the most likely expectation for the investment return on stocks would be in the range of 6% to 7%. I'll be cautious and project an annual investment return averaging 6%. Future annual speculative return, minus 2%? Now, consider speculative return. As 2017 began, the price-earnings multiple on stocks was 23.7 times. That figure is based on the past year's reported earnings of the S&P 500. If the P/E ratio remains at that level a decade hence, speculative return would neither add to nor subtract from that possible 6% investment return. Wall Street strategists generally prefer to calculate the P/E using projected operating earnings for the coming year rather than past reported earnings. Such operating earnings exclude write-offs for discontinued business activities and other bad stuff, and projections of future earnings that may or may not be realized. Using projected operating earnings, Wall Street's P/E ratio is only 17 times. I would disregard that projection. My guess, an informed guess, but still a guess, is that by decade's end, the P/E ratio might ease down to, say, 20 times, or even less. Such a revaluation would reduce the market's return by about 2 percentage points per year, resulting in an annual rate of return of 4% for the U.S. stock market. If you don't agree with my 4% expectation, do it yourself. You don't have to agree with me. If you think today's P/E multiple of 23.7 will be unchanged a decade hence, speculative return would be zero, and the investment return would represent the market's entire return. If you expect the valuation to rise to 30 times, I don't, add 1.5 percentage points, bringing the annual return on stocks to 7.5%. If you think the P/E will drop to 12 times, subtract 7 percentage points, reducing the total nominal return on stocks to minus 1%. My point is that you don't need to accept my cautious scenario. Feel free to disagree. Project the coming decade for yourself by applying the current dividend yield, there's no escaping that, your own rational expectations for earnings growth, and your own view of the P/E ratio in 2027. That total will represent your own reasonable expectation for stock returns over the coming decade. The source of bond returns, the current interest yield. Developing reasonable expectations for future returns on bonds is even simpler than for stocks. Why? Because while stock returns have the three sources identified earlier, bond returns have a single dominant source, the interest rate prevailing when the bonds are purchased. Yes, the current yield on a bond, or a portfolio of bonds, represents the expected return if the bond is held for the long term. Historically, the initial yield has proved to be a reliable indicator of future returns. In fact, fully 95% of the decade-long returns on bonds since 1900 have been explained by the initial yield. Of course, refer to Exhibit 9.3 in the accompanying PDF. Why is this so? Because the issuer of a 10-year bond is pledged to repay its initial principal at 100 cents on the dollar at the end of a decade, And for investment-grade bonds, that promise has usually been fulfilled. So virtually all of its return is derived from interest payments. Yes, in the interim, the market value of the bond will vary with changing levels of interest rates. But when the bond is held to maturity, those fluctuations don't matter. Exhibit 9.3 depicts the remarkably close relationship between the initial yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note and its subsequent 10-year return. Note the long cycle of its yields and subsequent returns from a low of 0.6% in 1940 to a high of 14.0%, amazing, in 1981, then falling all the way back to 1.8% in 2012, before rebounding slightly to 2.2% in mid-2017. The Treasury note carries minimal, or less, risk of repayment. That is, the risk that the principal value of the bond will not be repaid when the bond matures. So its current yield of 2.2% significantly understates the future returns on the broad bond market, because corporate bonds assume higher repayment risk. So I'll develop my expectation for future returns on bonds based on a portfolio consisting of 50% U.S. Treasury notes, now yielding 2.2%, and 50% long-term investment-grade corporate bonds, now yielding 3.9%. This combination produces a 3.1% yield on a broadly diversified bond portfolio. So, reasonable expectations suggest an annual return of 3.1% on bonds over the next decade. During the coming decade, the returns on bonds, like the returns on stocks, are likely to fall well short of historical norms. Refer to Exhibit 9.4 in the accompanying PDF. Over the long sweep of history since 1900, the annual return on bonds has averaged 5.3%. During the modern era since 1974, the return on bonds has been far higher, averaging 8.0% annually. That return has been driven largely by the long, steady bull market that began in 1982 as interest rates tumbled and prices rose. While lower returns are in prospect for stocks and bonds, balanced stock-bond portfolios will follow suit. Combining those reasonable expectations for future returns on stocks and bonds into a balanced portfolio consisting of 60% stocks and 40% bonds would give the expectation of a gross nominal annual return of 3.6% over the coming decade, before the deduction of investment costs. Of course, that expectation may prove to be too low or too high, but it may help to provide a realistic basis for your financial planning. In any case, that 3.6% expected annual return would fall well below the long-term average for such a balanced portfolio of 7.8% and the remarkable 10.2% return since 1974. Refer to Exhibit 9.5 in the accompanying PDF. When we convert these nominal annual returns into real, after inflation, returns, we see a smaller, yet still substantial gap. Historical, 4.8%. Since 1974, 6.3%. Coming decade, maybe 1.6%. See the table at the base of Exhibit 9.5. If rational expectations suggest a future gross annual return of 3.6%, for a balanced fund, what does this imply for the net return to owners of the balanced fund? In mid-2017, let's assume that 3.6% return is a rational expectation, not a prediction, for annual returns on a balanced portfolio during the coming decade. But remember, please, that investors as a group can't, and don't, capture market returns in their entirety. Why? Simply because investing in the stock and bond markets through actively managed funds carries an estimated annual cost of at least 1.5%. To calculate the likely return for the average actively managed balanced mutual fund in such an environment, simply remember the humble arithmetic of fund investing. Nominal market return minus investment costs minus an assumed inflation rate of 2% slightly above the rate that the financial markets are now expecting over the coming decade, equals just 0.1% per year. Here's the arithmetic. Nominal gross return, 3.6%. Investment costs, minus 1.5%. Nominal net return, 2.1%. Inflation, minus 2.0%. Real annual return, 0.1%. It may seem absurd to project a return of almost zero for the typical balanced fund. But if you will recall the lesson learned in Chapter 7, the average balanced fund investor will earn even less. The numbers are there. By way of comparison, in an environment of lower returns, a low-cost balanced index fund with annual costs of only 0.1% could provide a real annual return of, say, 1.5%, significantly higher than an actively managed fund. Not great, but at least positive, and almost infinitely better. Unless the fund industry begins to change, the typical actively managed fund appears to be a singularly unfortunate investment choice. The fact is that lower returns harshly magnify the relentless arithmetic of excessive mutual fund costs. Why? Equity mutual fund costs of 2% combined with inflation of 2% would consume only about 25% of a 15% nominal return on stocks and only 40% of a 10% return. But costs and inflation would consume, I hope you're sitting down, 100% of the 4% nominal return on stocks that rational expectations suggest. Unless the fund industry begins to change by sharply reducing management fees, operating expenses, sales charges, and portfolio turnover, and its attendant costs, high-cost, actively managed funds appear to be a singularly unfortunate choice for investors. A zero real return achieved by the average active equity fund should be unacceptable. What can equity fund investors do to avoid being trapped by these relentless rules of humble arithmetic? How can they avoid the financial devastation that follows when high investment costs are applied to future returns that are likely to be well below long-term norms? 5 ways to avoid financial devastation. Only 2 work. Here are 5 tempting options for improving your investment returns. 1. Select a very low-cost index fund that simply holds the stock market portfolio. 2. Select funds with rock-bottom costs, minimal portfolio turnover, and no sales loads. 3. Select winning funds on the basis of their past long-term records. 4. Select winning funds on the basis of their recent short-term performance. 5. Get some professional advice in selecting funds that are likely to outpace the market. Which option will you choose? Hint. The odds are high that the first 2 options will virtually assure your investment success in capturing whatever returns that our financial markets prove to provide. The odds of success for the final 3 options are pitiful. We'll discuss the limitations of each in the following 3 chapters. Don't take my word for it. Nearly every economist, academic, and stock market strategist who seriously studies the financial markets joins me in concluding that, yes, the good times we've enjoyed in the stock market since the lows were reached in the autumn of 1974 will no longer roll during the longer-term future. Consider these projections from AQR Capital Management, one of the largest and most successful managers of alternative investments. Expected investment returns are low. We expect a real return of 4.0% on equities and 0.5% on bonds, a 2.6% real return, before investment costs, on a 60-40 stock bond portfolio. These projections by AQR doubtless seem ragingly bullish, next to those of Jeremy Grantham, longtime leader of GMO, an advisor to major endowment funds. Over the coming 7 years, GMO expects a real annual return of minus 2.7% on stocks and a return of minus 2.2% on bonds. For a 60-40 balanced portfolio, a real return of minus 2.5%. Gary P. Brinson, CFA, former president of UBS Investment Management, echoes my theme. For the markets in total, the amount of value added, or alpha, must sum to zero. One person's positive alpha is someone else's negative alpha. Collectively, for the institutional, mutual fund, and private banking arenas, the aggregate alpha return will be zero or negative after transaction costs. Aggregate fees for the active managers should thus be at most the fees associated with passive management. Yet these fees are several times larger than fees that would be associated with passive management. This illogical conundrum will ultimately have to end. Or consider these 2006 words by Richard M. Ennis, CFA, Ennis Knupp & Associates, and editor of the Financial Analysts Journal. Today, with interest rates near 4%, they're now even lower, about 3%, and stocks yielding less than 2%, few among us expect double-digit investment returns for any extended period in the near future. Yet, we live with a legacy of that era. Historically high fee structures brought on by trillions upon trillions of dollars seeking growth during the boom and shelter in its aftermath. Second, facing the dual challenge of market efficiency and high costs, investors will continue to shift assets from active to passive management. Impetus for this move will be the growing realization that high fees sap the performance potential of even skillful managers. Chapter 10. Selecting Long-Term Winners. Don't look for the needle. Buy the haystack. Most investors look at the disappointing past returns of mutual funds as a group and think, sure, but I'll select only good performers. Sounds easy, but selecting winning funds in advance is more difficult than it looks. Yes, there are always some winners that survive over a quarter century, but not very many. But if we pore over records of past performance, it is easy to find them. The mutual funds that we hear the most about are those that have lit up the skies with their glow of past success. We don't hear much about those that did well for a while, even for a long while, and then faltered. And when they falter, they often go out of business, liquidated or merged into other funds. Either way, they vanish, consigned to the dustbin of mutual fund history. But easy as it is to identify past winners, there is little evidence that such performance persists in the future. Let's first consider the records of funds that have won over the very long term. Exhibit 10.1, referred to in the accompanying PDF, goes back to 1970 and shows the 46-year records of the 355 equity funds that existed at the start of that period. The first and most obvious surprise awaits you. Fully 281 of those funds, almost 80%, have gone out of business. If your fund doesn't endure for the long term, how can you invest for the long term? A fund failure rate of almost 80%. You can safely assume that it was not the best performers that have gone to their well-earned demise. It was the laggards that disappeared. Sometimes their managers moved on. The average tenure of active equity fund portfolio managers is just under 9 years. Sometimes giant financial conglomerates acquired their management companies, and the new owners decided to clean up the product line. These conglomerates, truth be told, are in business primarily to earn a return on their capital as owners of the fund's management company, not on your capital as a fund owner. Often, investors fled funds with lagging performance. The fund's assets shrank, and they became a drag on their manager's profits. There are many reasons that funds disappear, few of them good for investors. But even funds with solid long-term records go out of business. Often their management companies are acquired by marketing companies, whose ambitious executives conclude that, however good the fund's early records, they are not exciting enough to draw huge amounts of capital from new investors. The funds have simply outlived their usefulness. In other cases, experiencing a few years of faltering performance does the job. A death in the family. Sadly, a bit over a decade ago, The second oldest fund in the entire mutual fund industry was a victim of these attitudes, put out of business by the new owner of its management company. Even though the fund had survived the tempestuous markets of the previous 80 years, it died. State Street Investment Trust, 1925 to 2005, RIP. As one of the longest-serving participants in the fund industry, who clearly remembers the classy record of this fund over so many years, I regard the loss of State Street Investment Trust as a death in the family. The odds against success are terrible. Only 2 out of 355 funds have delivered truly superior performance. In any event, 281 of the equity funds that existed in 1970 are gone, mostly the poor performers. Another 29 remain despite having significantly underperformed the S&P 500 by more than 1 percentage point per year. Together then, 310 funds, 87% of the funds among those original 355, have, one way or another, failed to distinguish themselves. Another 35 funds provided returns within 1 percentage point, plus or minus, of the return of the S&P 500. Market matchers, as it were. That leaves just 10 mutual funds. Only one fund out of every 35 that outpaced the market by more than 1 percentage point per year. Let's face it, those are terrible odds. What's more, the margin of superiority of 8 of those 10 funds over the S&P 500 was less than 2 percentage points per year, a superiority that may have been due as much to luck as to skill. The Magellan Fund story. That still leaves us with 2 solid long-term winners that outpaced the S&P 500 by more than 2 percentage points per year since 1970. Allow me to salute them. Fidelity Magellan, plus 2.6% per year versus the S&P 500, and Fidelity Contra Fund, plus 2.1%. It is a tremendous accomplishment to outpace the market by more than 2 percentage points in annual return over almost half a century. Make no mistake about that. But here a curious, perhaps obvious, fact emerges. Let's examine the records of those 2 funds and see what we can learn. Exhibit 10.2, referred to in the accompanying PDF, charts the growth of Magellan's assets, shaded area, and its return relative to the S&P 500, black line. As the line rises, Magellan is outperforming the index. As it falls, the index is winning. Star fund manager Peter Lynch ran Magellan during its heyday, from 1977 through 1990. Since then, 5 different managers have run the fund as well. But more than manager skill or luck is involved here. Magellan's staggering asset growth must also be taken into account. As reported in the Wall Street Journal on May 28, 2004, Magellan Fund's then-manager Bob Stansky said that he expects to beat the market by 2 to 5 percentage points annually over time. I want to win. During Mr. Stansky's tenure, Magellan trailed the S&P 500 by 1.2% per year. He was replaced in 2005. This is a hard business. Its greatest gains were achieved shortly after Magellan began with assets of just $7 million. In those early days, the fund outpaced the S&P 500 by an astonishing 10% per year. Magellan, 18.9%. S&P 500, 8.9%. After the fund's assets passed the $1 billion mark in 1983, the fund's superiority over the market continued, albeit at a lower yet still impressive rate of 3.5% per year. Magellan, 18.4%, S&P 500, 14.9%, until the fund's assets hit the $30 billion mark in 1993. While the fund continued to grow, topping off at a year-end high of $105 billion in 1999, its relative outperformance failed to persist, losing to the S&P 500 by 2.5% per year. Magellan, 21.1%, S&P 500, 23.6%, from 1994 through 1999. The fund's underperformance continued after the turn of the century, trailing the S&P 500 by 1.8% per year. Magellan, 2.7%, S&P 500, 4.5%. Even as its assets fell dramatically, from $105 billion in 1999 to $16 billion at the close of 2016, a drop of 85%, with money pouring into Magellan when it was hot and money pouring out when it turned cold, this may be the classic case of counterproductive investor behavior. The Contra Fund Story. The Contra Fund story, so far, is not dissimilar to Magellan's story during its first 30 years. Great success followed by, well, reversion toward the mean. Will Danoff has been the lead portfolio manager since 1990. There's no way to fault his remarkable achievement with Contra Fund. Prior to Danoff taking the reins, the fund outperformed the S&P 500 by 1% per year. Contra Fund, 12.6%, S&P 500, 11.6%. Danoff has nearly tripled that annual advantage during his tenure through 2016. Contra Fund, 12.2%, S&P 500, 9.4%. Refer to Exhibit 10.3 in the accompanying PDF. Yet reversion to the mean always strikes eventually. Over the past 5 years, Contra Fund has underperformed the S&P 500 by minus 1.2% per year. Contra Fund, 13.5%, S&P 500, 14.7%. Yet success comes with its challenges. The fund's assets totaled but $300 million when Danoff took over in 1990. In 2013, assets crossed the $100 billion threshold. In the 3 years since then, Contra Fund's superiority has vanished, losing to the index by 1.5% per year. Contra Fund, 12.8%, S&P 500, 14.3%. The future? Only time will tell. When the reported investment returns generated by Magellan and Contra Fund were noticed by investors, cash poured in, and they reached giant asset totals. But, as Warren Buffett reminds us, a fat wallet is the enemy of superior returns. And so it was. As these two popular funds grew, their records turned lackluster. While few actively managed funds will soon reach the mammoth size that Magellan, and even Contra Fund, achieved, many, likely most, fund managers will face inflows when times are good and outflows when times are bad, a fundamental challenge to the industry's sensitivity to fluctuating fund returns. Living by the sword, dying by the sword. Not all Fidelity funds survived the test of time met by Magellan and Contra Fund. One example of failure was Fidelity Capital Fund, formed in 1957, and one of the stars of the go-go era. During 1965 to 1972, its cumulative return totaled 195% versus 80% for the S&P 500. Yet, in the bear market that followed, the fund fell by 49%. The S&P 500 fell by 37%. A few years later, its assets down from $727 million in 1967 to $185 million in 1978, it was merged into another Fidelity fund. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Look forward before you leap. But enough of the past. Let's talk about the future. Before you rush out to invest in Magellan or Contra Fund because of their truly remarkable long-term records, outpacing the returns of the S&P 500 by 2.5 to 3 times, despite their faltering in later years, think about the next 10 years or more. Think about the odds that a winning fund will continue to outperform. Think about the fund's present size. Think about the reality that over 25 years, the typical fund will replace its managers 3 times. Think about the likelihood that even a single investor has actually held shares of the fund throughout its lifetime. Think, too, about the odds that a given fund will even exist 25 years hence. Be equally skeptical of any mutual fund that has achieved superior relative returns over a decade or more in the past. It is a changing and competitive world out there in mutual fund land, and no one knows what the future holds. But I wish the very best of luck to the string of portfolio managers who will follow the present manager and to the shareholders of the funds they run. Whatever you decide, please don't ignore one of the least understood factors that shape mutual fund performance, reversion to the mean. The remarkable power of RTM will be explored in more detail in the next chapter. Don't look for the needle. Buy the haystack. The odds in favor of your owning one of the only two mutual funds, out of 355, with truly superior long-term records, were just 0.5%. However one slices and dices the data, there can be no question that funds with long-serving portfolio managers and records of consistent excellence, even over shorter periods, are the rare exception rather than the common rule in the mutual fund industry. The simple fact is that trying to select a mutual fund that will outpace the stock market over the long term is, using Cervantes' formulation, like looking for a needle in the haystack. So I offer you a cautionary corollary. Don't look for the needle in the haystack. Just buy the haystack. The haystack, of course, is the entire stock market portfolio, readily available through a low-cost index fund. The return of a low-cost index fund would have roughly matched or exceeded the returns of 345 of the 355 funds that began the 46-year competition described earlier in this chapter. 64 of the 74 funds that survived the long period, plus the 281 funds that failed. I see no reason that such a broad market fund tracking the Standard & Poor's 500 index cannot achieve a roughly commensurate achievement in the years to come. Not through any ledger domain, but merely through the relentless rules of arithmetic that you now must know so well. Indexing for a lifetime. Two major options: investing in 30 or 40 active funds and managers, or in one index fund with one non-manager. Look at it this way. If you're investing for a lifetime, you have two basic options. You can select, as is typical, three or four actively managed funds and hope you select good ones, knowing that their portfolio managers, on average, are likely to last only about 9 years, and that the funds themselves are apt to have a life expectancy of little longer than a decade. Result? You'll own maybe 30 or 40 funds over your lifetime, each carrying that burden of fees and turnover costs. Or, no surprise here, you can invest in a low-fee, minimal transaction cost, broad market index fund, with the certainty that the same non-manager will still closely track its index for the rest of your life. There is really no practicable way that a portfolio of actively managed funds will serve you more effectively and consistently than the index fund. Simplicity, cost efficiency, and staying the course should win the race. If you decide against indexing, we know that the index fund will deliver substantially all of the stock market's return. As to the actively managed fund, we know that fund manager changes will inevitably be forthcoming. We know that many of the funds, and alas, many of their managers, will die. We know that successful funds will draw capital in amounts that are likely to jeopardize their future success. And we accept our inability to be certain how much of a fund's performance is based on luck and how much on skill. In fund performance, the past is rarely prologue. There is simply no systematic way to assure success by picking the funds that will beat the market, even by looking, perhaps especially by looking, to their past performance over the long term. It is like, yes, looking for a needle in a haystack, and with no better odds for finding one. Don't take my word for it. Consider the words of Warren Buffett in his 2013 letter to Berkshire Hathaway shareholders as he describes the instructions in his will for managing his wife's trust. Rather than selecting an actively managed mutual fund with a superior record, he directed the trustees to invest 90% of the assets in the trust in a very low-cost S&P 500 index fund. I suggest Vanguard's. It is reasonable to assume that Mr. Buffett considered looking for the needle, but he finally decided to buy the haystack. Need more advice? With his customary wisdom, the late Paul Samuelson summed up the difficulty of selecting superior managers in this parable. Suppose it was demonstrated that 1 out of 20 alcoholics could learn to become a moderate social drinker. The experienced clinician would answer, "Even if true, act as if it were false, for you will never identify that 1 in 20, and in the attempt, 5 in 20 will be ruined." Investors should forsake the search for such tiny needles in huge haystacks. In the Wall Street Journal, longtime Getting Going columnist Jonathan Clements asks, "Can you pick the winners?" The answer, even fans of actively managed funds often concede that most other investors would be better off in index funds. But, buoyed by abundant self-confidence, these folks aren't about to give up on actively managed funds themselves. A tad delusional? I think so. Picking the best performing funds is like trying to predict the dice before you roll them down the craps table, says an investment advisor in Boca Raton, Florida. I can't do it. The public can't do it. To build a well-diversified portfolio, you might stash 70% of your stock portfolio into a total stock market index fund, and the remaining 30% in an international index fund. If these comments by a great money manager, a brilliant academic, and a straight-thinking journalist don't persuade you about the hazards of focusing on past returns of mutual funds, just believe what fund organizations tell you. Every single firm in the fund industry acknowledges my conclusion that past fund performance is of no help in projecting the future returns of mutual funds. For in every mutual fund prospectus, in every sales promotional folder, and in every mutual fund advertisement citing a fund's investment returns, albeit often in print almost too small to read, the following warning appears. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Believe it.
Chapter 11. Reversion to the Mean. Yesterday's winners, tomorrow's losers. In selecting mutual funds, too many fund investors seem to rely less on sustained performance over the very long term, with all of its profound weaknesses, than on superior performance over the short term. In 2016, over 150% of net investor cash flow went to funds rated 4 or 5 stars by Morningstar, the statistical service most broadly used by investors in evaluating fund returns. These star ratings are based on a composite of a fund's record over the previous 3, 5, and 10-year periods. For younger funds, the ratings may cover as few as 3 years. As a result, the previous 2 years' performance alone accounts for 35% of the rating of a fund with a 10-year history, and 65% for a fund in business from 3 to 5 years, a heavy bias in favor of recent short-term returns. How successful are fund choices based on the number of stars awarded for such short-term achievements? Not very. According to a 2014 study by the Wall Street Journal, only 14% of 5-star funds in 2004 still held that rating a decade later. Approximately 36% of those original 5-star funds dropped 1 star, and the remaining 50% dropped to 3 or fewer stars. Yes, fund performance reverts toward the mean, or even below. Reversion to the mean, RTM, is reaffirmed in comprehensive fund industry data. Other data on fund returns confirm the power of RTM. Consider Exhibit 11.1, referred to in the accompanying PDF, comparing the returns of all actively managed U.S. equity funds over 2 consecutive sets of non-overlapping 5-year periods, 2006 to 2011 and 2011 to 2016. We sorted the returns for each period into quintiles. The top quintile included funds with the best performance, and the bottom quintile contained those with the worst performance. We then looked at how those initial funds fared in the subsequent 5-year period. If it were easy to select funds that would outperform their peers by simply buying yesterday's winners, we would expect to see persistence. That is, most funds that ended the first period at the top of the heap would remain there in the next period, and those at the bottom would remain there. But no. As it turns out, RTM overpowers persistence. Consider the funds that ranked in the top quintile during the first period, 2006 to 2011. Over the subsequent 5 years, only 13% remained in the top quintile. A remarkable